This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Today, BP is claiming that they are siphoning off 5,000 barrels a day. But if you look at the video, you can see plumes of oil spilling into the Gulf, far in excess of 5,000 barrels per day. These videos stand as a scalding, blistering indictment of BP's inattention to the scope and size of the greatest environmental catastrophe in the history of the United States.
Nobody wants to say, if we cared for our children and grandchildren at all, if we cared about the world, we would stop all oil exploration anywhere today. Call it off. The atmosphere can't take another drop hauled out from under the sea, from under the land, from the tar. We will all drive away from this accident as though the greenhouse world isn't coming, arriving slow and almost unstoppable, visible and denied. Do you think I'm being too bleak? Just another climate alarmist? Professor George Martin Kennedy from the University of California, Riverside, made a speech April 8, 2010. It's called, What Awaits Us in the Greenhouse World? Watch the whole hour-long video with the link in my May 20th EcoShock blog. Snatching out a clip or two, listen how rapid climate change can be.
Now, what we're seeing here is that this stable period, we call the Holocene, is where human history has evolved. But the preceding 110,000 years is characterized by very rapid temperature changes. And these are significant changes. These aren't just small. Again, this is the difference between having a glacier on your doorstep and the difference of having a very hot Maryland summer. You know, it's really quite different. This shift from full glacial conditions, absolute ice age, to the warm Holocene occurred over three years. This is less than 10 years in change. So we know the Earth system can change like that. Now, what happened to initiate this change? It wasn't one of those nice linear ball rolls up, ball rolls down. What happened here was there was a massive meltwater release in the North Atlantic, and it utterly changed the circulation pattern of the North Atlantic Ocean. It shut down the Gulf Stream, and it entirely froze much of Europe in this period of very cold climate. Now, why that matters is it tells us that the Earth system actually functions rapidly, and it can function with triggers or past thresholds.
The forces that created a hothouse world for the dinosaurs are nothing compared to our industrial emissions.
The next question you might ask is, well, that was geologic time. 10,000 years ago is a long time, or 12,000 years ago even. Statistically, I'm pretty sound here. I don't have to worry about this. But the one thing that people that study systems, and particularly tipping points and thresholds, will tell you is in a strongly forced system, a tipping point is most likely. And by a common sense argument, we are in a period of Earth's history with the strongest pressure on the climate system that the Earth has ever seen. Now, that argument is really straightforward. There has never been a time in Earth's history when a systematic mechanism has mined reduced carbon. What I mean there is hydrocarbons and coal, oxidized them and put them in the atmosphere. No other animal, no other process, there is no other mechanism that you can identify, that I'm aware of, that could do what we have done. We have taken Earth's thermostat and we have jammed a blowtorch against it, in a sense. Boy, that sounds dramatic. But the point is, we are really forcing that thermostat. And this is the mechanism with which we're doing it. It's very straightforward. Every barrel of hydrocarbon we produce, we are putting that CO2 in the atmosphere, and that is our temperature controller. And there is another time in Earth's history when this could have happened. So, you get great Hollywood movies out of this, but this is not what I'm worried about. I am not worried about a giant tsunami coming into New York. In fact, it would be kind of cool, but this is not going to happen. So, this is not climate change. This is like a weather event. And frustratingly, the confusion of the press of weather with climate is really annoying, because weather is dramatic and it's extreme, and hurricanes are incredibly destructive, newsworthy things. But what we're talking about here is insidious, subtle, scary, nasty averages that change fundamental components of the climate system in ways that we can't see it until it's too late.
That was Professor George Kennedy from his video, What Awaits Us in the Greenhouse World. Go ahead and Google that. It gets worse. Dr. James Hansen of NASA says there may be no limit to the heating brought about by our sudden release of gigatons of carbon dioxide into the shallow atmosphere. It is not impossible to blow off the normal skin around the Earth of air, taking us into the superheated state of Venus, or maybe eventually the killing cold of Mars. Or this one, from our Radio EcoShock special on Greenhouse Worlds, broadcast January 4, 2008. Here is a clip from Dr. Michael Oppenheimer speaking to a meeting for financial movers and shakers.
What's going on now, definitely, is that the greenhouse gases are building up due to human activity, not due to these biological changes. And there's nothing to reverse that except us reversing emissions, nor do we know of any limit in the climate system that would stop the warming. There could be one. Maybe when we get to 4 to 5 degrees warming, there's something that happens that we don't know about. There's a lot we don't know. But, you know, we can't make policy based on a hope.
How darkly ironic. Now our best weak hope comes from the man who sees catastrophe coming, but a warming limited by nature itself, by the living reactions of Gaia. That would be Britain's James Lovelock. Is it possible? What could stop the roaring train of greenhouse warming we've released? In this program, you'll hear from a Gaian scientist and veteran journalist, Dr. Melanie Linnart. Her new book is Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. And if we have time, I'll also review another excellent source, a book from the Open University called The Cretaceous World. We have a lot to learn from the times of the dinosaurs when carbon levels soared along with the temperature. The mass of life, including forests, moved towards the ice-free poles. That may be the future, unless we undergo a revolution very soon, starting with a movement to leave the coal and oil in the ground where it cannot damage the sea, the sky, and all future generations. Meanwhile, let us see how the Earth balances itself in the coming greenhouse world. Most scientists now believe we are heading into a hotter world. Even 350.org campaigner Bill McKibben calls it Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, a new planet in the making. We humans plan responses, but we are not alone here. Mother Earth, or Gaia, is a mass of interlocking life forms and changing physical systems. And she has lived in ice-free worlds many times before. Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. That is the title of a new book by Melanie Linnart from the University of Arizona. We have her on the line now. Melanie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the first thing I noticed in your book, yes, you are a scientist with a PhD in natural resources and global change, but your work is stuffed with quotes from conferences, from discussions with other scientists, from letters and emails. And I thought to myself, this person has operated like a journalist as much as a scientist, and indeed, you are a science writer as well. So how did you arrive at this unusual marriage of research and journalism?
I actually started out as a journalist and spent about 10 years mostly in newspapers. I ended up getting a master's degree in forestry back in the early 90s, and that was when I first got interested in Gaia theory. I read about how the planet is a living system, and then right after that, I went to Puerto Rico to work on an internship at the Institute of Tropical Forestry at the time, and we were struck by a hurricane within about a week of my arrival there. It was a terrifying experience, and one of the reasons I feel so empathetic about people who are going through hurricanes. But one thing that really struck me is that the forest there, which actually took the brunt of the winds, recovered, at least appeared to recover within a few months. So that I was still on the island, and they were leaves had regrown where it had been like an apocalyptic vision. They were resprouting straight from the trunks. Now, it's very different than a clear cut because there was a lot of material still on the forest floor. So after that experience, then later I was working as a journalist, and I just kept coming back to that, like, I want to know more about this. how the Earth does it, why it's so resilient, or, you know, how it could be resilient if we get out of the way. And so that drew me back to graduate school. So it was actually the idea of working on this book that brought me back to get my PhD. So that's why I was working as a scientist and going to a lot of conferences, and was very lucky to be talking to some of the top climatologists of the time, and I was doing some writing for a publication there. So all that kind of came together, and it was very exciting when I finally got to merge those two sides of myself into this book and have the scientist side and the journalist side kind of merged together.
Well, the result of all that hard work had a lot of new facts and ideas for me. And I was sort of taken back to a radio conversation that I heard from Australia, where Gaia inventor James Lovelock suggested the climate would not enter a runaway state into a boiling disaster like the planet Venus. He said natural systems would limit the warming as they had many times in the past. Is that partly why you wrote this book?
Yes, I think partly just for that, to help people understand what we're facing. I guess my hope is still that we won't end up the kind of, even though it doesn't turn into a runaway warming, as Lovelock inspired me to originally think about how the Earth can survive somehow. It doesn't go off and turn all our water into steam. The whole planet has not frozen over, at least since life has evolved in insects and vascular plants. You know, it's still not really a good thing for society, so I think that part of my reasoning is just to let people know, one, that the planet is not really up for extinction, assuming that we were cleared out before it got that bad. I think the planet can survive much warmer climates than this. It's had greenhouse levels higher and temperatures much higher, but what you get during those time frames is almost a tropical condition throughout the globe. And that also means sea levels that are about 150 feet to 300 feet higher, which obviously would create many, many problems for us. I mean, even coast inland seas could cover large parts of continents. And that's part of the reason that wetlands expand during warmer climates, as do forests. So I think for the people who are worried that we're killing the planet, it's helpful for them to know the planet can survive this. But I guess I also wanted the rest of us who worry about our friends and family and you know, other species around to realize this is not a game. This is something that can happen. This has happened in the past, and the link between greenhouse gases and warm climate is pretty clear when you look at it at these long time scales.
Definitely. Well, for some listeners, I'd like to backtrack just a bit. And can you explain to us what Gaia is? How do you see it?
Well, I'll start out with how Lovelock originally envisioned it, which is kind of a system of interlocking life on the planet that has the capacity, therefore, to somewhat control climate temperature. And again, not in the terms of climate control where it's always 72 degrees, but more in the terms of, you know, we've got the poles, we've got the hot tropics, and we've had times when both of those were more dominant, but still life can exist. So that's kind of his philosophy, and that goes back to our planet. Instead of having 98% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere like Venus and Mars do of their atmospheric composition, we have less than 1%. We're working up to about 0.04%. And even that, you can see how much that makes a difference in warming our climate. Between that and the other greenhouse gases, the climate is warm enough to not be frozen over as it might otherwise be. So life has an important role, and of course, everybody knows that plants are producing oxygen. Our planet is 21% oxygen, which is what makes us as animals able to be mobile and get around, because we need that kind of energy. So that's kind of where it started from. And then he did add some refinements later to include the physical system, and that's where working with climate really got me interested in that side. And I began to think of hurricanes and some of these extreme storms, really any type of precipitation, as the sweat of the Earth. So just as we sweat, when we sweat, our drop of water that evaporates from our skin surface takes with it some heat, and that's why we sweat, to cool off. It's a way we cool off. Well, in a similar way, the planet, when it's evaporating water, lifts heat up, and kind of the circulation system, as we call it in climate, that move storms out around the world, basically from the hottest part of the world to cooler parts, and that's why hurricanes exist. They basically come up and in the heat of summer, just as the hottest days are kind of have been warming the surface, and you know, they move the heat out from the tropics into the subtropics and further.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Sunday night at 10:30 p.m. right here on Green 960 online and radio, San Francisco.
When it comes to hurricanes, one of the principal researchers has been Carrie Emanuel from MIT in New England. And I recall at first Dr. Emanuel said there would be more Atlantic hurricanes, and then he revised that to just more of the most powerful storms. Is that correct?
I don't remember him saying more hurricanes. I remember it was more intense hurricanes, and I think sometimes that might have been subject to different interpretations. As far as I recall, his premise has been that warming seas, he's done some really wonderful physics. I quote him quite a bit in my book. I have a lot of respect from him. But, you know, he just shows how sea surface temperatures really rev up hurricanes. And the paper that got so much attention was initially in 2005, which was published like a couple months before Katrina hit, just basically showed if you added up all the potential energy that hurricanes in the Atlantic are moving around, then you would see that the energy level increased. You know, they kind of were mirror images, the hurricane potential energy, destructive energy, we would call it, and the sea surface temperatures. So he looked at it like for each season, and, you know, it was alarmingly matched.
We know that a lot of the extra energy that's coming into the planet that's being mirrored back by this carbon dioxide cover and other greenhouse gas emissions, that a lot of that's going into the sea. So can we presume that that is the reason why we would get more powerful storms?
Yes, that would be when you've got extra heat coming in. Like you say, we're about 70% water on this planet. So a lot of that warming is going into the ocean, and it takes longer. You know, our land can heat up really quickly, but anybody who's been swimming on a hot day, the water is not always warm. It depends on where you're at. There's currents and things. But it takes longer for the ocean for water to warm up. So that has been where a lot of our heat has been going. And that's part of the reason why scientists are pretty confident that we've got some more warming ahead of us. Even if we stopped emitting all our greenhouse gases now, stopped driving and running electricity, we would still have some warming ahead of us for a little while because of that extra heat and the greenhouse gases that are already there.
On the other hand, James Lovelock and many other scientists say that eventually, perhaps in a million or many millions of years, without ice caps, the planet heat distribution systems like winds and ocean currents should stagnate, entering a relatively stable state. So I would presume from that the period of great storms may be a limited time of transition, even if it seems endless to our human time scale.
Actually, I don't see any evidence that hurricanes would stop. Now, when there's a difference between talking about regular winds, and so what they're talking about is now with the poles being warmer and the tropics being also warm, you wouldn't have as much of that gradient. A lot of times you get your winds from the cool moving to the warm or vice versa. Just things are moving around to fill a vacuum. Usually it's the cool moving to the warm. But in some of these times of the past, the poles were really toasty. Not only was the ice gone, there were forests there. Crocodiles were swimming up near Ellesmere Island in Canada. This is about 50 million years ago during the Eocene. So it was a completely different condition, and it even seems like some of that tropical rainfall was getting all the way up to the poles. So what that's saying is that the tropics are managing to get its precipitation pretty far north in this case. So there's actually reason to believe that hurricanes would kind of fill the bill and pick up. The tropics is still going to be warming faster than the poles in any climate just because the tropics are where the sunlight comes in most intensely. That's just the way our planet is configured. So somehow that extra heating in the tropics has to move out, and, you know, ocean currents could help and precipitation in general, but I think hurricanes would be one of the big things. And in fact, some Japanese researchers, led by last name Ito, I-T-O, found that if you look at evidence of past storms, there's a tremendous peak at about 100 million years ago during the Cretaceous when there was temperature was at one of its highest points in the record.
And we've just had the excitement of air cancellations from the Icelandic volcano, and I notice in your book you tell us that volcano eruptions might also dampen hurricane production. How does that work?
You know, it could very well relate to their cooling in general, because basically, now this volcano, I should point out, doesn't seem to have gotten its ash high enough where it's turning into a global phenomena. So at this point, it's mostly regional. It's Europe. It's at the height where planes are flying, and that's what's so much trouble with it. But it's when you get above that area, above the clouds and above the weather, really, that's when that ash can really make a difference for a year or so. It's basically almost like a shade over the planet. It's just a black ash blocking some of the sunlight. And so you're not heating up the ocean surface as much. That's a big one. And it tends to reduce precipitation in general because, well, for one thing, precipitation tends to increase as temperature goes up. So if you're cooling things down and not enough sunshine's getting through or as much, that's definitely going to affect evaporation rates, which is how you get your fodder for precipitation. So I don't think this volcano is going to cool things down from what it's done yet, but, you know, I don't know that it's done acting up.
Well, I guess it depends on whether it stimulates the volcano next door, but that's a whole another story. But I did want to ask you, is there evidence that storms were stronger millions of years ago when we did have hothouse worlds?
I think that the evidence that I've seen so far has been mainly that one I was just mentioning where they're basically looking at the wavelengths between storms from sediment deposits of these ancient storms. So there was a real peak 100 million years ago, and in fact, all around that time frame, the storms were a lot higher than what we've seen. Even within thousands of years ago, there's been other researchers doing work on sediments that are showing that we're kind of in a relatively low period, although I should also mention that during the ice ages, it looks like there weren't, and this is actually more based on computer modeling rather than sediments, but it looks like there probably wouldn't be nearly as many hurricanes because of the cooler temperatures and things. But as far as precipitation, so that's hurricanes, it's a little more conjecture based on modeling, but we know that the ice age planet had lower precipitation overall. So it was about half, roughly, of what we have now. And in fact, in those hothouse worlds, you would expect to get kind of a doubling because the temperature was about 20 degrees or more warmer on average. I'm speaking Fahrenheit here. And so with that kind of increase, you'd expect a doubling of the air can hold twice as much moisture when it's that much warmer.
And that, listeners, is the kind of fantastic information that you get from this book. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with scientist Melanie Linart, author of Life in the Hothouse, How a Living Planet Survives Climate Change. Tired of cheerleaders and phony media issues?
We treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are.
Looking for the awful truth? Dig in with Alex Smith.
Actually, you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Top scientists, authors, and activists, the ones you want to hear. No fear, Deep Green Radio EcoShock. Join us.